So we've said ciao, we've recorded some silence, we've put the red light on outside the studio, and we've posted security guards around the door to make sure that we're not interrupted for this, the best podcast in the world ever. It's Linux Voice Series 3, Episode 21. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this fun-packed podcast, we've got news. We've got an odd box. We've got some halfway reminders. We've got some finds of the fortnight, and we've got a voice of the masses. We do a magazine as well, but I'll plug that subtly later on, just so we can get on with it. Because I've got loads of discoveries, so we just get the news out of the way.
Finds,
quickly.
Finds.
I'm so sorry.
Two years we've had.
Right, should we move swiftly on with the best news in the world? Volume 1. Right, first up in the news, this fortnight, there's a new Raspberry Pi in town, and it's only $5.
Let me get it, hold on.
Oh, you've got one.
Ooh.
I tried to get one and couldn't.
Yeah, you wouldn't know this, Ben, but it was reviewed in the issue of Linux Voice that went to the printers last week. There it is. There is a pint of water, and there
wow.
is the tiny diminutive
the scale.
Pint.
Wow. Hold it there, Graham, and say something. I'll take a screenshot for the podcast notes.
I was about to ask why I needed to say something then for a screenshot, and then I realised.
Yeah, that's Hangouts, listeners. Whoever makes the most noise gets to appear in the big part of the screen. That's basically how our podcast works.
Shout louder, get more screen time. I didn't.
So, did you have, when you got it, Graham, did you have all the little connectors? Because
it's micro HDMI. That's not the same as mini HDMI, is it?
No, it's not the tiny, tiny one. It's basically, well, it's difficult to see. It's not the same, no. But
I was just trying to say, is it the same as the Odroid, or do you not know?
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. So I did, but yeah, you can plug it in. I mean, there's no networking either, which is the other thing. But of course, you can. There's just one mini USB port. There's one USB OTG for power, and that's it. And the SD card reader.
So this is basically the same as a Pi version 1,
overclocked
back all the way.
Yeah.
Overclocked to 1 gigahertz.
That's
yeah.
right, yeah. So I got it working with OpenELEC, the latest version of that, and it ran really well. I see that somebody's fitted it into a SCART plug. Use it for running emulators on. Somebody's fitted it into an Xbox 360 controller, or an Xbox, I think it might have been an original Xbox controller. And so the only cable coming out of it plugs into the TV for the emulation.
Hang on, they fitted it into a SCART plug, so they've done the SCART wiring through the GPIOs. Or is SCART just a really fancy form of composite? I forget.
I think, you know, it depends on the television. There's both digital and composite in SCART standards. So there is like there's RGB, but there's also a composite channel. I don't know because I've also seen somebody wire up an RJ45 connector to basically the GPIO pins. So, but yes, it's $5, £4. It's like eight grams. I weighed it for the review. it's a complete surprise.
I mean, I think it's potential for emulation looks great. I've set up RetroPie on a Pi 1 here, and it plays pretty much every SNES and Mega Drive game well. A few of them stutter when they got extra chips, like Super FX, and this Pi 0 is supposed to be 40% faster than the first Pi.
Well, it's the same as an overclocked Pi 1.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you wanted to, you can put the Pi 1 on turbo overclocking and you'll get the same performance.
But loads of warnings if you try and overclock your Pi 1. Is this Pi 0 somehow more stable? Or
I think the warnings were just a bit overblown.
Yeah. Okay. They say so. I mean, it's factory clocked. I think a Kodi is a good test because on the original Raspberry Pi B, especially with 1080p playback and stuff like that, you could sometimes see tearing, especially with the user interface and the OpenGL overlays.
But I think a lot of that changed due to software optimizations rather than changes in the hardware.
Yeah, yeah. But it works. It works faultlessly anyway. It's really low power as well. I can't remember exactly. Liz said something on the comments with how low power it was.
Yeah, another thing, Mike, is that the reason they might be comfortable clocking this one to 1 gigahertz is that it's only $5 to replace if yours burns up and you phone up for a new one under warranty.
Yeah. That's a good point, yeah.
They might say, okay, it's going to burn up 1 in 1,000 times, but who cares? It's just send out another one.
So the GPIO pins are identical in the identical positions as the Raspberry Pi 2. They're unpopulated, which means there's no kind of plastic header on there to be able to attach your wires to. But you can solder your own wires. The composite holes are still there as well, but there's no screen connector.
Is there any audio on it?
No, there's no audio. But then I remember there is no audio. So you're going to have to use a USB dongle or something. But I read somewhere that audio on the Pi anyway was just like a PWM output on the Broadcom chip. So it was nothing to shout about.
It was all right.
Yeah. They improved it greatly with the later ones.
Yeah. I don't suppose you know if you can get the audio out of the composite if you're willing to solder stuff on.
I don't think you can, but you should be able to get it out of the HDMI. Well, at the end point anyway, not
yeah.
The HDMI doesn't have audio to pins, for example. It's incredible. I mean, there's lots of small computers about, and I suppose we'll talk about it in the open ballot, but there's so many things that you can do. It's like like the Arduino Nanos and things like that, but this is a whole Linux computer.
You said open ballot, Graham. Damn. And before you were chastising Andrew for his discoveries.
Open ballot. Sorry.
Anyway, should we move swiftly on with the second greatest news story in history? Second greatest news story in history this fortnight is that LibreOffice has reached 1,000 developers. Just to clarify, this isn't 1,000 currently active developers. This is 1,000 developers have contributed since LibreOffice split away from OpenOffice in, 2010, was it? 5 years ago? That sounds about right. And this is a really great sign, because one of the sort of core reasons for LibreOffice splitting was that OpenOffice was quite unfriendly to new developers, and they've had a really big push to get new people involved to keep sort of pushing the software forward. And it's a really great project to get involved with. There's lots of people who are really sort of friendly to new developers, and they've just brought in, I've completely forgotten his name. Hang on.
While Ben's looking for that, I'll just note that the 1,000 number is especially impressive when you consider the complexity of the LibreOffice source code. We've all seen those diagrams of the interdependence between the components, especially back in the StarOffice and OpenOffice days. It is an absolutely mighty code base. The team have done a lot of work cleaning it up and making it more modular and sensible. But, you know, it's a relatively hard project to jump into, unlike, I don't know, GNOME or NGINX or something. You've got to spend a lot of time understanding how it all fits together.
That's NGINX, Mike.
Oh, okay.
That's what the cool kids say.
Yeah. And especially considering until recently, a large portion of the comments were in German, which, while a great language, has a much smaller pool of speakers. Jan Iverson is the new guy who's coming along to help new developers into the fold. They're also really, on all levels as well, they're really respectful to people. They have the bug hunting parties like the ones we announced last podcast, or we talked about last podcast. So it's all around a friendly project to get involved in, hence the 1,000 developers. Should we move on to some slightly less pleasant news now?
No.
Oh.
It's nearly Christmas.
Okay, there's been absolutely no unpleasant news this fortnight. This next item, I should point out, probably doesn't deserve to be in the news because it's based a little bit on speculation rather than actual fact.
Doesn't stop the majority of news outlets.
Yeah, but it doesn't stop the majority of news outlets. So we'll press on with it anyway. The Linux Foundation has pulled support from the Software Freedom Conservancy because of their lawsuit enforcing the GPL. This is based on the SFC have launched a crowdfunding campaign to try and get more donations. And they said that one of the reasons for this is the that some of their corporate supporters have pulled out following reaction to their enforcement or their support of Christian Hellwig in his lawsuit against VMware, enforcing the GPL and some of his contributions to the kernel. And you can look at the list of supporters from last year and the list of supporters from this year, and the glaring omission is the Linux Foundation. Now, the SFC haven't commented specifically on this, but they've said that they will be in much, they, like all organisations, will be in much healthier shape if the majority of their money comes from individuals rather than corporations, because corporations naturally have very sort of, well, different motives to individuals. And the Linux Foundation is a trade body. It's not, as it likes to pretend, a happy, fluffy organization that's there just for the good of the Linux kernel. It's there for the good of its members, which are large corporations that make money off the Linux kernel. And that's a very different thing. And I've always wanted to say this in a news story, but I haven't had the chance up until now. The Linux Foundation could not be reached for comment.
Did you ask them?
Yeah, I did. I've asked them what's going on, and they haven't replied.
They never really reply. I think I emailed Bradley Kuhn, the president of the Software Freedom Conservancy, and he hasn't got back to me, but that's because he's incredibly busy. And it's funny that this has cropped up now, because in the issue that's just gone to press, issue 23, we interviewed Bradley. And he's an incredible, intelligent person. He's dedicated his life, really. He worked with Richard Stallman. He worked at the Free Software Foundation, and now is the president of the Software Freedom Conservancy, to ensuring that basically that free software maintains its structure and its momentum. And that's exactly what the Software Freedom Conservancy is trying to do in enforcing the GPL and ensuring against violations are always targeted. And we had a discussion about the Linux Foundation and about it's important, I think, something we don't perhaps appreciate over in Europe, that just because it's called a foundation doesn't mean that there's any kind of altruism in what the Linux Foundation tries to do. Its responsibility, and this isn't a bad thing, but its responsibility is purely to the organisations who are a member of its foundation. It's a trade organisation.
And that's not just a sort of fluffy thing. Its legal responsibility is to those people. It's duty bound under its constitution to represent the interests of its corporate members.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's if we got together with other independent magazines and used our foundation-ness together to get better deals in WH Smiths and such, that's a good thing. Good thing for consumers as well. And it's a good thing that the Linux Foundation is helping to get Linux to make Linux more corporately acceptable, if that's what the word is. It does a lot of that kind of stuff. However, I mean, if this is true, I'm very, very disappointed. And I suppose, at least on a personal level, I think it sends out the wrong message, especially at a time when I think that copyleft licenses are becoming much less thought of in. Because it's just so much easier for everyone to move towards more permissive licenses like Apache or MIT. And this is something Bradley and I talk about in the interview as well. And the main problem is that we've all been able to do what we want to do because the Linux operating system, the GNU/Linux operating system, is free. And there are an open source alternatives, free software alternatives for all the main things that we want to do. And what I'm worried about is that in 5 or 10 years, the software that's built on the foundations of the licenses we're using today won't be free enough for us to be able to, for our future selves to be able to do the same thing and enjoy the same freedoms that we've been able to do. And while it might be convenient for some people to choose MIT or GitHub to default to MIT, it isn't going to be convenient in the long term or the medium term, which is exactly what Stallman's been saying since the 80s. And that's exactly why it's so disappointing if the Linux Foundation has removed its sponsorship of the Software Freedom Conservancy. Sorry, turned into a bit of a rant.
I mean, it is worth mentioning at this point that the lawsuit that the Software Freedom Conservancy are supporting is against a member of the Linux Foundation, VMware. But it's also, to my mind, the very job of the Linux Foundation is for the other organizations there to also to pull VMware into line, because they're also violating their GPL code. I mean, Google have got a lot of code and they're also a member, which and VMware are ripping that off, as are many other organizations there.
Yeah. But I mean, Google are generally quite, Google's a big corporation, so there are parts that don't know. But as Bradley said, actually, the Google are quite good. I mean, the fact that they've got someone like Chris DeBona in an open source kind of division that understands the complexities of licenses means that they're responsive. But that doesn't stop them developing a lot of stuff in private. Who knows? And also, it's probably worth saying that this case with VMware hasn't been resolved yet. It could be that VMware is innocent, as they say they are.
But there's nothing fundamentally unfree about developing stuff in private and then releasing it.
No.
I mean, that's a model that GNU did for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. And I do feel that the momentum is moving away from copyleft purely because there's really a new development model. There's a new layer of computing and developers who really have no memory or recollection of what the GPL is and what the GPL has made possible. And there's only a few people at the Software Freedom Conservancy. They had to do a crowdfunding campaign to fight this VMware battle. There's only like three different foundations who are capable of fighting against GPL violations. WordPress is one of them. The FSF, the FSFE are another two, and the Software Freedom Conservancy. So few people, so few resources fighting something so fundamental to all of our software freedoms. I sound like I'm sounding like more and more like Stormin as I get older.
But at least you haven't got the hair yet. Shall we move on to some happier news?
Yes, please.
Adobe has decreed that Flash is now dead.
Fine.
This is deja vu. I'm sure we've had this.
Yeah, this has died several times.
This is about once a year we announce that Flash is dead. This time they're saying you shouldn't use it anymore in new projects. They've renamed all their tools that create Flash. They used to have, I forget what it's called, like Flash Design or whatever it was. That's now called Animator Design or something like that. And to be honest, yeah, as you say, Flash in almost all cases has been dead for quite a while now. Except, of course, for adverts. Advertisers are still using it wildly around the web, and that's not going to change just because Adobe tells them not to. But I say that, I haven't actually had Flash turned on in my browser for 6 months now. Right, the final item on our list of news this fortnight is Let's Encrypt. This is the project from various free software people, the FSF, Mozilla, I think, others, to basically make it really easy to generate certificates for HTTPS, so secure web communication. So try and get everyone on using this encrypted web traffic. It's in public beta today as we record this. If you're running a website, you can now feel free and for very easy get a HTTPS certificate, which also is a due reminder for us. We really should turn on encryption on our web server, and it's been on my to-do list for far too long, and I'll just wait for this podcast to go out, because that's obviously a big spike in traffic and I don't want to kill it then, and I'll do it after that.
I think the key word here is that making it easy as well, isn't it? I think they've been free or very cheap SSL certificates for a while, but setting it all up has been a royal pain. I've never even really looked into it, but the idea is if you can make this really simple, like if somebody can make GNU PG very simple for all email and webmail, then it will get much, much larger adoption.
Yeah, it's a great initiative. The old way was sold, fashioned, and always, you know, if the companies that offered it were always really trying to get you to buy an expensive certificate, which were identical anyway.
Yeah, so the sort of guts of this is a couple of command line tools, one which creates new certificates, one which configures Apache to use them. There might be equivalents for Nginx and other browsers as well, I'm not sure. So it should just be setting up a couple of cron jobs. Happy days, you've got secure certificates forever.
Excellent. I will try that this weekend as well on my site.
And that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent. Thanks, Ben. So it's now time for Finds of the Fortnight. As usual, going online and starting recording, I asked the IRC channel. We've had a few. P Waring says, this looks like an SQL command. Show create table and then table name in MySQL will give you the SQL to create table name in another database. Also, MySQL can display results vertically. If you end a statement with slash G instead of semicolon. So there's a big SQL discussion now. Dot schema table name is the same for SQLite. Still void. Not a recent find, but I've recently rediscovered and been using a lot Eagle mode. Eagle mode, the best file manager in the world ever.
So trippy.
Still void. Also, materialize, which materializecss.com, which is someone who occasionally has to knock up a quick prototype of software. It's a great library for building material design websites very, very easily. I've seen that. Still void. Also, if you'll excuse the plug, I have a new Pebble watch face out called Slowness. Okay, I'll put Still Void's new Pebble watch face in the link. Atom is great. Second that. Vim is really good. Oh, edit. Editor Wars, Vim, blah, blah, blah. Tree View, yep, that's good. We'll give that a go. Anyone? Oh, Largamon. Apt-get-y upgrade will not install kernel updates. Aptitude-y upgrade will. That's good. I use top, atop, and htop a lot in my headless servers. Nmon, a resource monitor. Wow, Nmon is like GK Realm, which I install on GUI-ed installs. The aptitude thing, there's now a discussion about whether that aptitude fine was right. So there was loads of good stuff there. I'll try and abbreviate them and put them in the notes.
I've literally only just discovered you don't need the get on apt-get. Apt install something works as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Really?
Yeah, and you can, instead of apt cache, you can just do apt search apt without hyphen. A hyphen. So it's apt space install, apt space search.
I didn't know that either. It's a lot of that's muscle memory.
Because yeah, I've no idea how long it's been like that. I just discovered it. I think I might have forgotten to type the get.
Wow. That's a serious amount of finds in 30 seconds. Yeah. Does anyone else want to have a go?
I'll have a go. I'll get mine out of the way. And both of these were actually emailed me, emailed to me again. So the podcast is sort of making itself now, which is very useful.
if only, Mike.
Yeah,
but just record yourself.
Sorry?
If you could just record yourself before you send it in and we'll just hit play and sit back.
Yeah, yeah. We could just put all the tracks on random. The first find is from David Baxter, who points at the Bunsen Labs distro that some people may have heard of. The website of this says, Bunsen Labs Linux is a distribution offering a lightweight and easily customizable open box desktop. The current release is Hydrogen, built on top of Debian Jesse. The project is a community continuation of Crunchbang. And then David goes on to say, the current release has an ISO available for download at bunsenlabs.org, and there's still the great support community forum. I've been using it for 4 months on my desktop and now on my laptop. It is a superb example of open box and conky loveliness. Thanks, David. That's good for the fans of Crunchbang who were disappointed when that distro ended. And then another find comes from Christian Graulund, who said, first of all, I really enjoy the podcast. Thank you for making it. Secondly, in light of the recent discussion about privacy and encryption, I would like to point you to the existence of illegal primes. These are prime numbers that have been made illegal because they can be interpreted as a program that then perform an illegal function. A Wikipedia page for illegal prime has a section, first illegal executable prime number, that shows a prime number that can be interpreted as an ELF file that compiles to a program that breaks a form of DRM for DVDs, the CSS content scramble system. Thanks, Christian. I don't know much about all this maths and stuff. Can you shed any light on this, Ben?
I haven't come across them before, but I'm assuming what you're saying is the binary code for this prime is a valid ELF file, purely by chance.
That's the sign of alien intelligence, isn't it?
Surely, I mean, an alien couldn't make a new prime number. That would have to be an intelligent designer, surely.
Well, no, because if the structures in numbers is a resonance of some deeper physical manifestation that we don't understand, then maybe. Or I think it's actually interdimensional. I think that prime numbers are really just the peaks of some kind of graph drawn in 12 dimensions.
Yeah,
and so there's an ELF file running in the 12th dimension.
So you're saying that our universe was designed on the basis of x86 machine code?
We are Ooh, Skynet.
I love machine code.
Sticking with the pointless stuff that's illegal, I only found out recently that UART cables are covered by US export restrictions.
Really?
Presumably because some of the US's bombs have UART ports on them.
Is that like just traditional serial ports? Or?
Yeah, so the old-fashioned serial ports where the only ones I've got are going to the USB port of your computer, and you have like four wires that come out, a positive, a minus, and a transmit and receive. And you just flip the transmit and receive and connect two together to create a serial connection. You can use them for debugging the boot sequence on, you know, Raspberry Pis, and I've used mine on my on other little ARM boards just to get into the boot sequence and get it working before the terminal comes up.
Those are my finds anyway. I don't know if that leads into Ben's.
I can happily go on with my discoveries. I can't even remember which one's right anymore. They're discoveries, aren't they?
No.
Finds.
I can't remember either.
My first find is one that's been emailed to me as well. And this is following on from, I've mentioned a few times, I have pains in my hands when using the computer. I've tried various things. And a guy, Martin Latter, has emailed me what some things that worked for him. And one of them, it's one of those things that seems so obvious when you're, it's mentioned to you, but I just didn't click before I got this email. And it's using two mice. So you just have two mice plugged into your computer at any one time. And as soon as you start to get pain in one hand, you switch to the other hand. And you sort of give that hand a rest and then you switch. Because you can have two mice plugged in permanently and they'll both work at the same time. I don't know if you've ever tried this.
Can't you just move the mouse to the other side of your...
Well, you could do that, but that's the additional... Well, there's two things to that. One, that's an additional burden in actually having to move the mouse where you just go, sod it, I'll do it. And the second thing is the mouse I have is actually a right-handed mouse. You can't use it in the left hand.
We can see it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can see it, but viewers can't. Listeners can't even. It's been tilted about, I don't know, 80 degrees, so you hold it with your hand vertically rather than horizontally, so you can't turn it upside down. And that, it just makes it really easy that you can... what I actually find works really well. I imagine like most very strongly right-handed people, I just can't use a mouse in my left hand very well at all. It sort of moves wildly across the screen. And I'm sure that would get better with practice. But what I find is I can use the movement in my right hand and the buttons with my left hand. Oh, actually makes it easier.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, just like on a joypad, you have direction with your left thumb and firing with your right thumb. Yeah.
So I only got this email yesterday. It might have been the day before yesterday. So I've only been playing around with it for a little while. So I don't quite know how it's going to work out. My concern, obviously, is that it's just going to mean I get more pain in both hands. but we'll see. I'll give it a crack and I'll see what happens. The second discovery I find this fortnight is that I've been running a honeypot. This is a sort of basically, it's a fake SSH server that allows you to log in with really easy passwords, and then it sort of monitors what you do. It doesn't really give you access. If you try and do anything nefarious, it stops you. You can't run executables and that sort of thing. And it just monitors what people do when they try and crack into your server. And I guess the first find is you get a phenomenal amount. This is running on my home ISP connection, so this isn't like a public, isn't like a server or anything like that with a DNS pointing to it. It's just a normal home internet connection, and it gets probably around 30 odd attempts to log into it a day, just from hackers around the web. They're just scanning the IPv4 address space, and so far, well, a lot of people will guess the password because the password's ridiculously easy. But no one, most people don't actually then log in. They're just checking what passwords work and then they move on, which I find interesting. Most people don't even try and log in once they've got the correct password.
Do you think that information's then sold on to somewhere else?
Well, I've been looking through the logs of somebody else who's been running a honeypot for a lot longer, and they sort of collect all the stuff that people download when they do try and do stuff.
Yeah.
And one of them was, it was a Perl script that was doing this very thing. It was just pinging it. And then they just got it to email them the list of working IP addresses, usernames and passwords.
Right.
Periodically. So whether that's sold on, whether it's stored for later use, whether they're working on the principle that the password's so easy, it must be a honeypot and they don't want to get trapped. Who knows?
Yeah.
But also, yeah, looking through this collection of stuff that I found in someone else's honeypot, the things that people do when they do try and log in surprised me a little bit. The most popular thing was to create a DDoS botnet. That's fairly obvious. You sort of expect that these days. But the second most popular thing was people just trying to run game servers. People downloading Half-Life and that sort of thing and trying to set it running as a server.
Wow. So that's not really a script then. That's somebody who's just wanting a Half-Life server.
And then the next most popular one was just scanning to try and find more vulnerabilities.
So this really explains why we lost the connection with you about 5 minutes ago.
Oh, it could be actually.
That's really interesting. Are you gonna write anything about that? You're gonna kind of dissect. That'd be cool. I'll
do something about with that. And those are my finds.
Excellent. Shall I go next? A bit in my follow-up to, I was talking about the Black Phone and the fact that they had a user-segregated privacy. I've finally installed Exposed on the CyanogenMod mod phone that I used, which is like a huge kind of modifications framework. And one of those modifications is called X-Privacy. And people probably know about this for people who hack their phones already. But X-Privacy gives you really fine granular control over exactly what every single process and app does on your phone. And can also do things like not only disable the GPS, but also inject dummy data if you want it to. And while it may sound a bit of a hassle, it uses profiles for the majority of known applications that you can just choose the defaults from. But it also lets you do things like stop the incredibly draconian Amazon app from constantly talking to back to base. It can also remove ads from things that you can't normally remove ads from and do other stuff like that. And you can it's a good solution. Requires more hands-on, but if you've got a rooted Android phone, maybe running CyanogenMod, I could highly recommend it. The other find is kind of stolen off Kader on IRC, who mentioned it last week. I made a note of it, and it's a command called enter, ENTR. And what this does is it waits for change in the file system and then runs a command. So a good example is ls*.html pipe into enter and then reload browser Firefox. So Firefox will be forced to reload when Entra detects a change or an update to the HTML file or files that it's used to open, but you can use it. Your imagination kind of explodes with potential for this. So if you're working on a C source file and you save the change, Entra could be watching that and it could run the make process or the build process or the link. Or you could have it if a photo changes or if a directory changes. Basically, it allows you to write any kind of script easily that respond to changes in the file system or just on the command line. It's a really cool little command. And they're my finds.
Then it must be time for my finds. So, first find. First find is that I was in the bank yesterday, or the day before yesterday, because I wanted to pay one of our contributors in Russia, Valentin. And I've tried to do this online, but Russia's on the naughty step with North Korea and Iran. So we can't set that up online. It has to go through an additional step. So I went in, and because my phone's playing up, so I couldn't do it over the phone. I said, oh, hello there, I'd like to make an international payment. And do you know why? Is there any reason why I can't do this, set this up for myself on online banking? And the person I spoke to said, oh, I'll ask Adam, Michael, whoever. He's good with computers. And it was like, I don't know, it was like a flashback. Like, cause I'd not heard this phrase spoken for ages. You know, who says that anymore? He's good with computers. It's not about being good with computers. You know, the system that you use every day runs on a computer. It's about being good at, you know, stuff that you do day in, day out all the time. So that was strange. That was a bit of a mental dislocation. But anyway, I'm sure our money's safe.
Yeah, and I'm sure Putin's chafing a little bit at us not being able to make the payment so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that's helped in the war on terror. Yeah. Absolutely. And then another thing, which was, again, not Linux related, but my mum and dad bought a laptop. We're compelled to buy a laptop for a child they're fostering, despite this being madness, utter madness. And they asked me to set parental controls for it. And in order to do that, so there is a system of adding different users, different local users. But you can't control what the usual parental controls are, you know, access to the internet times, access to certain applications, you know, internet website blacklisting or whitelisting. You can't do that with like a Unix, Linux style user controls setup, which exists in Windows 10. Instead, you need to create a Microsoft account for that person. So in order to keep your child safe online the Microsoft way, you have to create for them a Microsoft account so that they get used to having an email system that can be continuously pried upon by Microsoft and its carefully chosen commercial partners. You then have to email the child at this Microsoft account and say, oh, Andrew Gregory wants you to be part of their family. Do you accept? And then the child, or in this case, me, emailing myself on an email address that I just made up, has to then click, yes, I accept. So you either have to get a kid to, you know, there's no way of doing it without the kid knowing that you're watching them, which is probably fair enough. But it's not a decision for Microsoft to make. Or you have, you know, 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds who you want to use the family computer, who you're obliged to create a website, an email address for. And what's a 4-year-old going to do with an email address? All you want to do is make sure they're not, you know, they only watch 2 hours of Peppa Pig at once, otherwise it'll fry their tiny brains. It seems like it's just a ludicrous amount of control and data that Microsoft wants from you. I mean, obviously we know this. This is how their business operates. But to extend that to the children, I mean, won't someone think of the children? And the fact that they're doing this in the name of protecting children online it's just perverse and just a bit weird and creepy. And it took me ages and ages to do it in the living room with the fire on and the radiators on, with Strictly Come Dancing blasting out right next to my head. And yeah, and I was driving, so I couldn't have a drink.
But I bet- Andrew, are you just upset because your mum's still controlling you?
I think that's all of our finds, isn't it?
In which case, may I be rude and jump straight into the odd box and neuron section, because I only have 5 minutes, because I have to go very shortly. We have an odd box from Jason Kemra, or Tsemra, so let's hear it.
Hello, the voice that you hear right now is a custom-crafted vocal package modelled off the venerable Mike Saunders. You could say I am his robotic counterpart. There are many open source vocalizers, and they are much better.
Okay, I think that's enough of that. This is a customized voice file for Mike Saunders vocal synthesizer. So thanks for that, Jason. We'll put the full version up on the website and link to it in the notes. We had a neuron from John Whitmore, who wrote that he'd been to LinuxCon Europe in Dublin, which he really enjoyed. It's quite a long one, but I just want to quote from it when he said, "Linux is simply a hardware abstraction layer for running Emacs." And finally, one a neuron from Daniel Vredenburg, who says, "Good day, Linux Voice team. Thanks for a great magazine and your efforts in the FOSS community. I just wanted to make a point about your recent Voice of the Masses discussion concerning rolling releases. The most common complaint in the comments section was stability, with Arch often being used as the prime example. However, it should be made clear that rolling release doesn't necessarily mean bleeding edge. It seems many people were either confusing the two or equating them. Rolling release simply implies a distro that never needs a fresh installation for a system upgrade. That does not necessarily mean that you will always have to have the latest software version. A prime example of this is Linux Mint Debian Edition. I've been running it for a while now and never had any issues whatsoever. Rolling release? Yes. Bleeding edge? Hardly. In my opinion, bleeding edge is a philosophy, whereas rolling release is a strategy. I think it's an important distinction to make." Thanks for that, Daniel. It means we managed to get that section done in about 3 minutes, so that must be some sort of record.
If you've got to go now, do we need to just somehow plug in the mic voice synthesizer so that it can continue in your stead?
Is this a pub opening time in Bavaria, Mike?
As the ghostly silence echoes through the room, we keenly feel the loss of Mike.
We do.
I can get Begbie up. Put a pair of headphones on him. I don't think he's got much to say, though.
Zap has been quite talkative recently.
Okay, that'd be cool. So let's open up the... Oh, no, I said I was going to subtly promote the magazine, didn't I? I need to do that first. Oh, hang on, we've had a halfway reminder yet.
Oh, dear.
It's all gone to pop. Mike, come back! So it's time for our halfway reminder. Still to come, Voice of the Masses. That's it. Now it's time for a subtle reminder to buy the magazine. Buy the magazine.
I think that's saying it straight.
I think people appreciate straightness, honesty, and all that.
Shall I just start whispering, "Buy the magazine," while other people are talking, to try and sort of subliminally plant it?
Yeah, say it backwards. Nisi gamath yab.
I'd be really impressed if we play that backwards and it says "buy the magazine."
I would be impressed, I'd be terrified. So it's time for Voice of the Masses then. There's been that thing about the Raspberry Pi Zero, hasn't there? Which is now cheap. I mean, this is another discovery which I'm gonna put in here just because really. In the caption to the Raspberry Pi Zero review, Mike Graham, it said it was cheaper than a pint of beer, and that really shocked me because it's £4.
Yeah.
Where are you drinking?
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Let's go. You get two pints of crisps and change for the bus ride home in York.
I
can remember when it was like 98 pence.
Well, we've started if we start with Graham, then that's the end of it, isn't it? Because you're the eldest, so you win. we should have done it in a different order. Or instead, we could just get on with Voice of the Masters. So the Raspberry Pi Zero is out. It's really cheap. There's also something called the chip, which is also cheap. And that is the world's first $9 computer, which was crowdfunded earlier this year. Now the Raspberry Pi in dollars is $5. So we get into a price point where it's no longer, the hardware is no longer the limiting factor. It's how many pints of beer you need to have to give yourself the idea that you need to program on it, or it's postage, or it's peripherals. But the actual hardware itself, the price of it, it's almost irrelevant now, unless you're buying in huge bulk. So with that in mind, what gets you more excited, the chip or the Pi Zero? The chip is not really something I've seen much of on these shores. Is it more of an American thing?
Yeah, it's mostly because the postage to the UK makes it more than that.
Right then, and that brings us into Mark C, who says, if the chip ever becomes widely available without extortionate shipping, I think it will be the better general-purpose computer. But the Pi Zero will be the better embedded device, prototype with a desktop B+. That's a desktop. He's putting question marks as if the Raspberry Pi B+ is a desktop machine. Prototype with a B+, then move to the Pi Zero once you no longer need a keyboard and a screen attached. Brian also says the no, it doesn't. Sorry. Yes, Mark also says there's no point trying to get a chip in the UK as the postage costs more than twice the cost of the chip. Wow.
Yeah, I think the best thing about the Pi Zero, which sounds terrible, but it is that it's disposable. I mean, you can buy them from Pimeroni for £4, not including delivery. But you can put them in things. You can put them in create a little submarine and put it in the river and see what happens. You know, you don't have to worry about it. You can sew it into clothing. I suppose if we should imagine if we were in the US and buying the chip and in the UK buying the Raspberry Pi Zero.
I mean, I think the thing that really surprises me about the chip is, yeah, you can buy the computer for $9, but it doesn't have any video out, or it only has composite out, which is rubbish, frankly. Even if you've got a monitor that will take it, your eyes will go blind trying to make out the fuzzy lines on the screen.
Yeah.
It's $15 for a HDMI port. It's almost twice the price of the board. So then really comparing it to a full fat Raspberry Pi, and for that money, the Raspberry Pi is going to win every time. Yes. It's faster, it's got more gubbins.
And the chip's had difficulty satisfying deliveries and meeting deadlines as well, hasn't it? I mean,
well, it's been pushed back a little bit, but I think we can cut them some slack on that, provided they get it out pretty sharpish, like they say they're going to,
yeah.
Because it was...
an ambitious project, yeah.
Yeah, and... You know, not everyone has the wherewithal to push out a magazine, so a computer on exactly the time scale they say they do after a crowdfunding campaign.
That must be incredibly difficult, actually, to do a crowdfunding campaign and yet hit your target when you say you're going to do it. It must take all sorts of brains, experience, know-how, good looks.
Yeah, especially if they were to get it in shops on the time they said they were.
Yeah, retailers. Just in the high street. It's like a whole other can of worms, isn't it?
I think fewer than 20% of all projects actually managed to hit their targets.
Wow.
And that probably includes people, you know, crowdfunding bobble hats.
Potato salads.
To be fair, bobble hats are probably really difficult to make at scale.
That I am completely ignorant of the effort involved in putting together bobble hats.
So, Stuart says, the Pi Zero has it, one, because it's part of a family compatible with others in the range, and two, because it is British, and we are great at these resource-constrained solutions. Finally, three, because it comes from a non-profit that is helping education and open source.
Yeah. It's built in Wales, isn't it? It's still built in Wales.
I was having a look at the two from a purely sort of speed perspective and sort of totting it up. They've both got a 1 gigahertz processor, but the chip is an ARM V7, whereas the Raspberry Pi Zero is an ARM 11, which sounds like the Raspberry Pi Zero is fast, but actually it's not. You'd expect the ARM V8 to be the ARM V7 to be faster. However, that's not taking into account the fact that the amount of effort the Raspberry Pi Foundation have put into optimize Raspbian for this very chip. So when it actually comes down to it, I wouldn't expect it to be that much difference in terms of performance. Expect the chip to slightly edge it, but not by as much as the hardware would suggest. And on the flip side, I'd expect the Zero to have better graphics, although I don't have a chip to test this out on.
What software operating system do we expect the chip to run?
Linux. It'll be. I don't actually know which version it will be based on.
Right. Because the Pi Foundation has done an awful lot of work in optimizing for its own hardware, hasn't it?
They've done a phenomenal amount of optimizing for its own hardware, and a reasonable amount of that will pour onto other ARM-based devices, but not everything will.
Kano Donkey says, I am excited by both of them, and let's face it, at these prices, you can afford to buy both. Personally, having Bluetooth and Wi-Fi built in is a plus for me, so long as the Kickstarter campaign actually delivers.
Hmm.
Let's give ourselves another pat on the back, actually, for how awesome we are.
It must be the time of the year that we're feeling nostalgic for that.
Oh, yeah.
That more innocent time.
Yeah. Now, Orange Dolphin says, I've heard about the chip months ago and wasn't bothered to inquire. One tweet announcing the Pi Zero had me running like a crazy ferret around southeast London till I got my hands on one. It might just be the marketing, but in my mind, the chip blends into the sea of devices I would get if I had unlimited time of money, while the Pi Zero evokes associations like revolutionary, cool beyond description, and they got this exactly right.
Yeah.
The left side of the brain sees the price tag and chooses not to interfere. Plus, I do have a sweet tooth, so yeah, Pi beats chip anytime.
And also, I mean, there's all of the... It fits directly into the Raspberry Pi ecosystem.
I think that's a little bit unfair because we might be saying the same thing about the chip in 4 years' time.
But right now, you can do any of the projects that you can with a normal Raspberry Pi and just use a £4 Raspberry Pi instead.
Yeah, but if you say that, then there's never going to be a competing device, and you've got to cut them a little bit of slack to build up, I think. We'll see how they go, because obviously the Raspberry Pi Foundation have done a huge amount of work, both in getting resources, making it easy to use, and that is going to take any competitor time to catch up on. When the Raspberry Pi first came out, you know, the software was unoptimized, it was a pig to install, it was flaky, you know, you had to remember the days when you had to try and work out which power supply would actually work for you, and even some mice weren't working properly.
Yeah.
Mices, I don't know.
Moose.
But can I take a moment to plug the small computer that I'm excited to receive? This is completely unrelated to either of them. It's the ESP8266, and it's not a computer in the sort of general scheme of things. It's more of a microcontroller. In fact, what it is it's purely a Wi-Fi chip that happens to have a programmable microcontroller in the middle of it. And I've got one on order now. And you can buy them for £2. And it's capable of running. The version I've got has got like a few gubbins on to make it a little bit easier, USB port and that sort of thing, and it comes in at £3. And that's capable of running a full HTTP stack over Wi-Fi.
Wow.
And runs off, you know, tiny, tiny batteries because there's nothing of it to use any power. And yeah, it looks like a really interesting device. A bit awkward to use, I think, but not too bad at this point. A lot of work, yeah, some very clever people have worked out how to make it easy.
And
it should be arriving the next week or two. It's coming from China, so it'll take a while, but I'm really excited by it. I don't know why, for some reason a computer for £2 seems ridiculous to me, although £4 isn't much better and much more expensive.
Well, back to the subject of money. Rocket Dog says, personally I want a Pi 3 with a few GBs. I want a Pi 3 with a few gigabytes of RAM, onboard wireless, and a SATA port. I would happily pay £100 or more for it. It could be used to raise extra cash for the foundation.
I mean, there are, you know, more powerful ARM boards with more features on. In terms of the Pi 3, I know we spoke to Evan about this when the Pi 2 came out, and he said basically expect the same refresh cycle. So that's 3 years, is it? Yeah. 2.5 years between the Pi 1 and the Pi 2. So we should be expecting it in, what, about 18 months? But that was the plans then. Anything could change.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the future, it'd be nice to see the networking decoupled from the USB. And I mean, I think networking, it is a bit crippling that the Pi Zero doesn't have any networking on it.
That's why you want an ESP8266.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That is actually amazing.
I mean, you say it doesn't have any networking on it. That is quite bad, but it's, you know, you can.
Yeah, it's complaining about a £4 computer.
Yeah. You know, how much is a USB Ethernet dongle? It's about £1.50 these days, £2.
Yeah.
So they're aimed at different people, aren't they, obviously? The chip and the Raspberry Pi.
To be honest, I see the Raspberry Pi Zero as more a competitor to the Raspberry Pi compute module than anything else. It's something, you know, you prototype your stuff on the Raspberry Pi B or whatever, where you've got everything, and then you refine it all the way down. And then this, I imagine people not even putting the headers in, but soldering directly between that and the expansion board they want. And
I think that's part of the reason why networking has been taken off, because you can't see it to the list, show it to the listeners. But the profile is, because all of the connectors are very low profile, it must only be a few millimeters high. You know, there's no RJ45 on there, so you could really fit it into almost anything.
Yes, Trivia Dave says, like most people, I think the Pi Zero looks to be the overall better system, largely because of the existing community already mentioned. The chip sounds fun and I should have one in a few weeks, apparently before Christmas. I think the thing that appeals most to me, though, is the height of the Pi Zero. I would like a right-angled GPIO header to attach to a Pi Zero. I don't know if such a thing exists yet. I assume that someone will make it if enough people want it. But I assume it is possible to make fairly easily. You could then make much slimmer devices while retaining much of the functionality.
You can get right-angled header pins. I can see no reason why you couldn't solder those on.
Mm-hmm. Trivia Dave rounds off by saying, overall, I think it's a really exciting time for computing. Both projects show inventiveness and will let people experiment with tech at a much lower price than has previously been an option.
Yeah, that's a good way to end it, isn't it? It's all this choice and, you know, low-cost computing just makes it more accessible to so many more people and makes more projects feasible.
Well done to all concerned.
Right, so do we call it a day? Should we follow Mike to the pub?
Yeah, let's shall.
Yeah.
When does your flight leave Bristol?
To hop on the Bristol Flyer in 20 minutes. We'll be in Munich by lunchtime.
Right, so thanks everyone for listening. Thanks everyone for joining in, and we'll speak to you in 2 weeks.
Yes, thanks. Ciao.
Ciao. Bye. Bye.
Bye.